me to join the panel that he's doing at 2 o'clock Pacific time, which is on recent developments in fusion and particle physics. And then at 3:30, I am presenting an item on peaceful uses of nuclear detonations, starting with my copy of the Project Rulison film, which you may have seen on my Tubnix account. It's listed in the programming schedule as a video presentation, but I actually also have a slide deck and a lecture that goes with this. Here at the convention, actually, I have supplied an art exhibit. There are 12 art panels. Six of them have six posters by the great science fiction illustrator Kelly Fries, which I picked up at the Washington, D.C. Worldcon back in December. And the other six panels have 12 photographic art prints that were commissioned by Interatom in the 1970s. And I've printed out cards giving the captions and so on to distribute to folks. I've got a lot of stuff here. I've got my levitating moon globe. I've got a portable DVD player so people can watch various videos that I have. I've got displays of coins and medals and badges and simulated nuclear fuel pellets. This is what I do, the thing is. If you ever wonder, you know, I'm always begging for money to support my activities. If you wonder what my activities amount to, a great deal of it is this: going to places where people might be receptive to a message and talking at them, sounding them out, trying to get people to, maybe take a little more active role. If you've seen Lunarcy, the movie that I was in, you're probably familiar with the sort of thing I do. There's actually footage from the Reno Worldcon 11 years ago in there. And, of course, if you haven't seen Lunarcy and would like to see Lunarcy, the easiest way is to ask me for a copy, and I'll mail you a DVD. In fact, I have a pile of the DVDs here with me in case anybody at the conference wants a copy. So, I saw, by the way, someone on Reddit recently who had managed to find at a thrift store something that I would dearly love to have. That was a display of non-simulated nuclear fuel materials. Somebody at the Energy Research and Development Agency, the sort of Nixon-era stopgap between the Atomic Energy Commission and the Department of Energy, had made up this plaque with uranium, starting with ore, and then yellow cake, and then uranium hexafluoride, and then enriched uranium hexafluoride. It was all samples of the real stuff. He picked it up at a thrift store. Man, I would have loved to have that, and you know I would show it off to people. I would put it to its highest and best use, for sure. And probably get me in real trouble, but what else is new? SMJ asks if I have a Geiger counter. Truth is, I have various radiation detectors. I bought a bunch of Geiger tubes a while back with the idea of making custom circuit boards for them. And I've never actually got around to it, which is another of my problems. I do, however, have a tritium vial in my pocket. This is a little short one, not the big long one I use as a nightlight in my bedroom, but a little short one that I intend to have find a nice translucent gemstone like an opal or maybe smoky quartz, have it drilled into and the tritium vial inserted, and then have it mounted for use as a watch fob. Let's see. Bob Jonkman asks, what is a Geiger tube? The answer is, a Geiger tube is a very specialized capacitor. It is typically a long, narrow diameter metal tube with a metal wire down the center. It's got terminals at each end, which are insulated, and it's filled with various kinds of gas. It may be argon, halogen, an organic substance, and you set up a voltage, a tension, between electropotential field, between the center wire and the shell. And when an ionizing radiation, such as a gamma ray, passes through the tube, it causes ionization in the gas, as you might expect. Well, because the electropotential is high enough, this causes a cascade. And so ions bump into ions, bump into ions, and the entire tube discharges in a moment. And so a Geiger counter is a device which counts individual instances of ionizing radiation. It does not tell you what the energy of a given gamma ray is. Geiger tubes are insensitive to energy, but it counts events. It's a major tool used in measuring ionizing radiation. Now, there are also proportional counters which do help to measure energy. Those are very, very useful in nuclear science because they have the property that they allow you to fingerprint individual radioactive substances. In effect, every radioactive substance has a distinctive distribution of energy of the gamma rays that it emits. It's also possible to build counters that are sensitive to alpha and beta emitters, alpha and beta particles. This is a little more difficult just because they have a shorter range. But an alpha detecting ionization chamber is at the heart of your home smoke detector. But yes, proportional counters allow you to identify specific radioactive substances, which is an incredibly powerful scientific tool. For example, in research reactor, and you may have heard my shows, my previous shows about research reactors, you can take an object and insert it into the reactor where the neutron flux causes it to become radioactive, then you pull it out of the reactor again, and you put it in front of a proportional counter. The proportional counter, by measuring the energy of the gamma rays, will tell you what isotopes, not just what elements, but what isotopes of what elements are in that sample and what the proportion of them is. So you can get a very, very accurate picture of the composition, even down in some cases to parts per billion of some substances. SMJ asks, americium? Yes, americium-241, a byproduct of reprocessing plutonium from used nuclear fuel, is commonly employed in smoke detectors because it is a pure alpha emitter. And its immediate decay product, neptunium-237, is also a pure alpha emitter with very little gamma radiation, beta radiation, anything like that that's unwanted in a home smoke detector. Now, the Soviets did build smoke detectors with plutonium sources. And at one time, I believe, there were a few made with radium sources. But anyway, that's one of the things, as I say, about nuclear energy, is that it is possible, because we have such enormous sensitivity of detection, that if there is a release of radioactive material, say from a nuclear power plant, or from a facility which handles medical isotopes, or anything like that, it's very, very easy to trace the stuff back to the source, to identify where it came from. And this is one of the things that makes nuclear energy as amazingly safe as it is, because you can always monitor and detect, and you will always have an indication of something going wrong. People have this idea that just because you can't see it or hear it or smell it or taste it, that radiation is obscure, but this isn't really true. The fact is, we have amazing sensitivity of detection. Anyway, let's see, what else do I have to say today? So, warming to my theme, as I so often do. Hello? Warming to my theme. Now, I've said in the past, or at least I hope that I've said in the past, that I don't see it as being very useful normally, to think of things in terms of enemies, right? I don't think that it's useful to look at people or things and say, this is an enemy of progress, this... But there are things that are obstacles in getting to where we want to be. Hello, I'm actually live on an internet radio program right now. Have a look at this at the display. If there's any questions you want to ask, I'll just throw them answers right into the show. But there is one thing that I want to talk about, and this is an attitude. I would say that it is an enemy, but it is an attitude. Not a person, not even a thing. And the attitude can be summarized with the phrase, as above, so below. The motto of the ancient Egyptians, as above, so below. All this has happened before, all this has happened again. All this will happen again. The joyful wisdom of Nietzsche, of which Chesterton said, if that's what he thinks is joyful wisdom, I shudder to think what he thinks is sorrowful wisdom. The ice cream lady has come.
Yes, would you like an ice cream?
Give me a Klondike bar, ice cream lady.
Yes.
Thank you. Ice cream lady in this case is actually my highest value Patreon patron. Patreon.com/Publius_reads for those of you following along at home. Ice cream. Klondike bar better than Roseanne bar by a long chalk, if you ask me. As above, so below. All this has happened before, all this will happen again. Because the implication of that, there is nothing new under the sun. Everyone has a place, and that place is ordained ahead of time by God, and that place can be known if you only know the circumstances of their birth. And I don't believe that. Indeed, I object to that. I would counterclaim, yes, everyone has a place. Perhaps it's even a preordained place. But the only way that you can know where that place is by finding it. So saying that people should stay in their place is absolutely wrong. But it is that mindset. You know, many people talk about traditional values, this, that, or the other thing. And I'm not saying that we should discard the whole of past human experience. I am opposed to that. It seems like foolishness. Because past human experience teaches us a great deal about human beings. But there is another side to this. There is another thing to consider, which is that past human experience, by definition, occurred in conditions which are different from those of the present day. The world has changed. And not merely through the kinds of changes where you could say, well, the cultural patterns that were appropriate to the Ice Age may not be appropriate to the time after the Ice Age, when the flora and fauna are different, the weather patterns are different, and so on. But also, our world has changed because we have changed it. We humans, we have changed it. What do I mean by that? Well, you know what? You've heard me many times say, in fact, I've said it at this convention over and over and over again, the farmers who grow the corn in the United States are growing it with tractors, not with animals and not with stoop labor. And their tractors even are air-conditioned. By the sweat of your brow, you shall eat your bread all the days of your life? Nice try, God! I'm sorry, that's a bit sacrilegious, even for me. But as I've said before, I find it objectionable when people try to claim that the way they feel things ought to be is the will of God. Well, if somebody else claims that, I can claim it too. But, yes, as above, so below. You can see it over and over and over again. Well, this is the black neighborhood. Right. Or, well, women don't ought to act like that. Or what have you. Sorry, little break there while I took a bite from my Klondike bar. The one problem with a Klondike bar is that unlike a Dilly bar, it doesn't have a stick in it. But, so I'm here at the science fiction convention because people who are interested in science fiction are already more receptive to the kind of message that I have. Now, Bob Junkman asks, is Publius making political commentary on recent United States Supreme Court decisions? I actually try to avoid that mostly. But since you asked, I am going to make a certain comment. I'm going to make a comment about this so-called prayer in schools decision. Now, I'm not going to comment on any of the things that deserve to be commented on about the decision itself. Many other people have said many cogent things about it, which I'm not going to repeat. No. What I'm going to say is something quite different. You see, I don't know whether the plaintiff in the case, the coach in the case, right? I don't know if he was plaintiff or respondent. I can't remember off the top of my head how it went. I don't know whether the man in the case had sincere religious faith or not. I would assume not. I don't believe 1 in 20 people who do things like that has any sincere religious faith. Why do I say that? You see, people who have the kind of public prayer, right? People who lead public prayers in such a way that people feel pressured to join in, right? He's on the 50-yard line of the football game. You know, football being the big thing in many American states. A football coach is the highest paid public employee in more than 40 out of the 50 states of the United States, right? Football is essentially the national religion of Texas. Where are people on Sunday mornings in Texas? They're at the football game, not at church. Now, he's at the 50-yard line praying, and the students, right, the players who are students in the school who are under his authority, right, they feel pressured to join the prayer, whether or not they believe in what he professes to believe. And this is the key. My opinion of this guy is that he has no sincerely held religious beliefs, but like many people, he really, really enjoys the sensation of power, of seeing people he has authority over performing meaningless rituals and shibboleths in order to placate him. It's not God that he wants to propitiate. It's himself. He wants other people to treat him as a god, as someone whose will must be obeyed, and to perform ritual behavior and mouth words that they may or may not believe. It's not whether they believe it that he cares about. It's that they do it because he wants them to. This is the equivalent of the worst kind of religion. This is, in fact, I should say, exactly the kind of religion that Jesus denounces in the Gospels. And that is what ties into my message today. as above, so below. People whose religious opinion essentially is that God oppresses them and they can oppress the people beneath them. This is the slave mentality at work. Because who's between the master and the slave? The answer is the foreman. The foreman kisses up and kicks down. That's the structure of the slave society. Kiss up, kick down. And you see it all around you in your business world, for example. Kiss up, kick down. And what is kiss up, kick down characteristic of? Well, I've said masters and slaves, but it's broader than that. I call it the patron-client society. Some people might refer to it as plutocracy, but the fairer description, I think, is a patron-client society. Now, what is a patron-client society? A patron-client society is one in which a relatively few people have a whole lot of power, and you, the majority, right, the ordinary person doesn't really have rights. If you want education, if you want medical care, whatever it is, right, you've got to placate and propitiate the person who has power over you. And that, my friends, that is key to understanding. As above, so below. All this has happened before. All this will happen again. Nothing new under the sun. Everyone has a place, and you can know that place by the circumstances of their birth. These are maxims of a patron-client society. In the patron-client society, there's no way out. If you're a client, you're a client all the way, from your first cigarette to your last dying day. What was it Thomas Paine said? I have sworn eternal enmity against any form of tyranny over the mind of man. Old Tom Paine knew what he was about. And the thing is, I'm not atheist or anti-theist, anti-religious or anti-clerical. I may have given you that impression, but it isn't true. I simply don't believe that what people are doing in the name of religion is really being done in the name of religion anymore, because of religion, any more than things they claim to do in the name of something else are being done for that reason. People who have power are exercising power because they can, and it brings them satisfaction. So what do we have to do, right? What is the key to building the kind of society that atomic energy and space travel allows us to build? Well, I would say that the very first step has to be, in fact, maybe not the very first step, maybe every step, something that should accompany us every step of the way like a walking stick, is a rejection of this business of allowing psychopaths to have power over us. Now, maybe psychopaths isn't the right word. Maybe I am unfairly maligning people with a mental disorder. But you know the people that I mean. People for whom the appeal of power is that they can make